Okay. All right.
You're limited?
Yes, ma'am.
If you don't mind, I want to show off something really quickly. Gabriel and I have been working with drawing his name, and this is what he came up with today.
Very good.
So, I know it's backwards, but the point is he's getting the letter, so I was really impressed, and I wanted to show it off.
That's very good. Very good. You know, I met this lady in Chicago, and I was up there to teach them how to read Hebrew and giving them some Hebraic teachings. And this lady wrote upside down and backwards on the paper. She had the thing turned around, and she would write on that. I thought, you're doing the right thing. You're writing from right to left. But very good. Very good. Batman is picking up his intelligence skills, huh? Very good. Okay, questions? Anybody, what inspired you this week?
Your evidence?
Yes, sir.
I don't know if it inspired me or not, but your sarcasm sometimes tickles me. Because I was reading along there and it says, well, to me, this is due to the great amount of empty space between her ears. That guy ain't right.
Dr. Elisheva, says you need to live with me.
Try growing up with him.
Well, you know, sometimes you want to say things like shithole nations, but you really should curb your tongue, you know. So, that was a kind way of putting it as far as I was concerned. There's,
Are you into the comics and the newspaper?
No, not at all.
Well, I read Dilbert.
Okay.
And this just goes along with they're talking about how to insult somebody without them knowing that you're insulting them. And so this just reminded me of that.
Very good. See if you can. Can you read this? Can you see it?
Yes, I can't read it, but I can see it. When I grow up, I want to write services. Servicing.
Sermons.
Sermons. Bless you, my son. How much do you pay the guy that writes for you? 10%.
I just happened to be in a book that we're going to use a little bit this evening, so... Okay, I'm glad that inspired you at the home, Navi there. Who else? What else?
Well, I did want to say that I've been trying to do the homework, that question number one.
Very good.
And I'm trying to connect, like, the question. Of course, the question in this one is, can the teacher, like you say, the children or the Talmudim, can the teacher make the student stumble? And what would be the punishment thereof of the student stumbling?
Say it again. If it can make the students
stumble, stumbling block in front of the students, and what would be the consequences if he does.
Okay, very good. Okay.
That's kind of what I got.
Okay, but that's good. That's very good because that's very much a situation. We'll talk about that in a minute. Excuse me. Very good. Anyone else?
Your Eminence?
Yes, sir.
I would just like to say you left us with another unfair question at the very end. You said, what are the things that you can imagine that need to be done for your eternal Shabbat? It's not a simple question to answer.
But it's something that you definitely should be thinking about because the sages say that the world that you build is going to be the world that you live in. You build that world from here. You build it. You don't get to wait till you get there and then you build it and then say, oh yeah, look at here. I got a mansion on the hilltop or whatever it is. If you're going to have, quote, the mansion on the hilltop, you've got to build it now. So there's a lot of work that we need to do to ourselves, and I'm not saying by any means that we're not worthy of that world, but when we get into the Yom HaMashiach, the days of Messiah, there is an opportunity at that juncture to correct many of the things that we did wrong, but more than correct, it's to build from where we started. So, for example, if we didn't get perfectly versed in how to read Hebrew, when we get there, we can finish our education. And the same is true, say, if you're looking at Greek, and you have 613 commandments to learn, and their application, etc. But simple things can often be things that you do that correct your behavior now that will be things that will make you the person that you are trying to become. One of the ways that the rabbis talk about your judgment is that we can talk about it in many different ways, you know, a literal judgment and who's going to be there and who's not going to be there, who's our accuser, and on and on. And each one of those things has something to teach us. But on the higher end of understanding the judgment, we understand that the judge will be yourself. And that is because, obviously, all of us understand that we know what we are deficient in. And many times, you know, our Yetzer Hara is actually the one that is griping and hammering at us, you know, saying, you should, you should, you should. And the Yetzer Hara is actually correct, but it uses it in a negative way, and the negativity that it uses is like condemnation. You're not doing what you're supposed to do, and so then we feel guilty, and so we have to learn how to moderate the Yetzer Hara. But it's a very, very important question. So, very good. Anyone else?
Yes, Your Eminence. Mine was on 41, and it's in the notes on 96. It says it says total annihilation is reaching the 50th negative level. So I was just wondering what was that? And when I looked it up, I don't know if this is what you were meaning, but it says on the 49 gates of impurity that a person can fall to, but still be able to arise and correct his soul. Correct. However, falling to the 50th gate is irreversible, at least in the same incarnation. Is that...
You complicated the matter with the last word. Okay? But let's just do that, because you understand the idea of transmigration, okay? You move from this level to the next level, etc. Okay, that is an ultra complex idea with regard to your neshama, not your nefesh, your neshama, which is the higher portion of your soul and function of your soul. I say that your neshama understands the whole process that it has to go to do its particular job. Okay? That being said, your neshama can pick... It can see like Adam did. It can see, of course, like God does. It could see from one end of the world to the other, so to speak. So it can see all of history. But it can see its part in history. So it understands what it has to do throughout history to accomplish the redemption that is its job, that specific neshama's job, okay? So it may only be able to do so much with a particular nefesh, which is a soul, the lower part of the soul. Okay, so it may be only able to do so much with that. So it says, okay, I can only do so much here, and I have to change, and I have to do this. But for example, one of the things that you can imagine is that right now, in the migration, if you will, that we have right now, you have a family heritage. You have DNA, etc., all these things that from your family history. It's your job to do a particular work of tikkun on that DNA. But the next migration, you may not even be associated with that history at all. You may be in a whole nother history. And so if consistently throughout different migrations, and I will say it like this, if someone gets to the 50th negative level, actually the idea is annihilation, which means that that soul is cut off. And it's the difficulty is that not only is it cut off and not any longer capable, it's not capable of itself, not that God forbids it. It cannot do it. And so if it is annihilated, what happens is that it is extinguished from existence as if it never had been. And that's very difficult, especially when we look at all the interrelationships that we have with people. How will it be to have interacted with someone who had reached that level and have been annihilated? And somehow all of that will be that Hashem just eradicates that from our memory or whatever. But it is very, very complex, and it's deeply, deeply sa'od. And that's as far as I'll go right now, okay? Because it is very complex. But that was my intention, and it's interesting that you added the transmigration, because that's very important. Because it may be that, you know, this individual has, you know, at one point not been able to do it, but he's given the next transmigration to try to repair that, etc. So.
Evidence?
Yes, sir.
You brought up something that came to me this morning when I was doing the Shacharit, because I just recently discovered that during the Amidah, you say a confession, you say a vidui.
Vidui, huh? Vidui.
You get through with the Amidah and you say another vidui. You can't. And I'm going, you know, and I was struggling with this. And then I thought, well, maybe it's because there's different, so the soul, the different levels of the soul, the transmigration of the soul needs this repetition.
That's correct.
Is my moral face right? I mean,
no, you're correct, because the soul, what it needs to do is, you know, in essence, you were doing what Hakam Shul said, right? We redeem the time because the days are evil. So if you're redeeming time, if you're redeeming something, that means you have to do a work of redemption. So a vidui is a confessional, but it's also a repentance. Okay, so when you do that repentance, what you're doing is you're healing that particular confession, whatever you've confessed there. And that's one of the reasons why I truly enjoy the evening Shema, or the bedtime Shema, more than the evening Shema, because it attaches a vidui, and it's as if it cleans us before we go to bed, before we go to sleep. And quite frankly, the soul, and I've said this many times, and I know many of you have heard me say it, but it's not the body doesn't need the rest. The body is going to keep on pumping blood and doing exactly what it does all day long. The mind doesn't need its rest because it keeps on dreaming and doing everything that it does. So what happens is the soul needs to be refreshed, and it has to go with God. So this is why we say in the morning, the Modei Ani, okay? Thank you because you returned my soul. In other words, you know, I still have work to do, and so thank you. And you acknowledge essentially that you're going to have your part in the resurrection. Okay, so each one of these things gets us to the place. So for example, the evening vidui prepares us so that we could die. Because in essence, that's what we are. We're 1/60th when we're sleeping. We're 1/60th of death. And then the dreams, 1/60th of prophecy, etc. So it's very much the same that, you know, on Shabbat, just before Shabbat, we do particular things that are actually preparation for death. So the vidui is very, very important each time that you have to say it or get to say it. So yes, it each time it's doing a different job, but it's accomplishing a repair of some sort. Very good. Any other questions? Okay. Very good. Let's jump in. Page 40. Now for me, the simple connection between the Peshat and the Remez portions, it's almost as if they just flow from one to the other. And that means that you can hear what Yeshua is saying in these passages, and then you can see how to solve this problem in the Remez. But let's start on page 40, and the top of the page with the Peshat. And whoever brings an occasion before one of these faithfully obedient little ones to sin, it is more beneficial for him if he wears a heavy millstone around his neck and for him to be thrown into the sea. Now, question. Is this... we're reading up a shot, but is this really literal? Are we literally saying, you know, okay, that, you know, some guy that he does this to... anyone, let's just say this before we define the little ones, but is it really saying, well, let's just tie a concrete block around his neck and throw him in the sea? And he's...
No,
it's not literal. He's using like a figure of speech. So you understand that, you know, we can say, you know, take a long walk off of a short board or something like that, you know. It's just, it's a figure of speech. And so here it's basically a figure of speech only for the sake of generating a mental image. You know, when you hear about this guy that's got something tied around his neck and he's going to be thrown into the sea, you know exactly what's going to happen to him. Okay, so it's a little bit outside of the realm of just being Peshat, and it leads to a little bit of Remez, okay? Okay, so before we go on any farther, let's look at here, and it says, one who brings an occasion before one of these faithfully obedient little ones to sin, okay, who in the world are the little ones? We're talking about the kids? We're talking about, what are we talking about?
The new converts?
New converts, okay. That's a part of the answer, but yes. Generally, they can be new converts or?
Students.
New students, okay. All right. Let me read you a piece. This is by Alfred Edersheim in his book, The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah. It's not necessarily important for you to have that book, although there are some things in there that are helpful, such as this piece here. But even if such had existed, the worship and the addresses of the synagogue would not have offered any opportunity for the questioning on the part of Jesus, which the narrative implies. Now, he's talking right now about where Yeshua, at Passover when he was 12 years old, is discussing something with the sages, okay? And so still more groundless is the idea that there was in the temple something like the Beit HaMidrash, which there was, or a theological academy. Okay, now he's talking here strictly about the temple only because that's where, number one, that's where the he would have gone in the pilgrimage festivals is to the temple while the temple stood. Okay? And so the time that he is speaking about is Passover. And so, you know, the discussion that Yeshua is involved with the sages has something to do with the Passover. Okay? But, by and large, here, he's talking about the Beit HaMidrash, which means the study house, like the yeshiva. Okay? So we can get a picture of all yeshivot, all the study houses, from this picture of how things went at the festivals at the temple. Not to speak of the circumstance that the child of 12 would not at any time have been allowed to take part in the discussions. Okay, so he's questioning here whether at 12 years old would Yeshua have been capable or allowed to have a discussion with the rabbis. Not sitting in a group with a bunch of other little boys his age or older than he or whatever. The students are sitting in front of the rabbis, and if they have a legitimate question, they're capable of asking. If they're not, then it's like, shut up. He said, but there were occasions on which the temple became virtually, though not formally, a Beit HaMidrash. For we read in the Talmud, Sanhedrin 88b. Now, one thing about him is that sometimes he doesn't get his sources exactly right, so sometimes you have to fish for it a little bit. For we read in the Talmud, Sanhedrin 88b, that the members of the temple, Sanhedrin, who on ordinary days sat as in a court of appeal from the close of the morning to the time of the evening sacrifice, and were wont on Sabbath days and feast days to come out to the terrace of the temple and there to teach. It is such a popular instruction that utmost latitude of questioning was being given. It is this audience which sat on the ground surrounding the mingling with the doctors and hence during and not after the feast, which must seek the child Yeshua. Okay, so in other words, the sages of the Sanhedrin, and this would be much more than just the Sanhedrin, would use the temple as a teaching ground, and they would sit the students, generally they would sit in rows. Okay, now let's go on for just a minute and then we'll discuss how this works. He said, but we have yet to show that the presence of the questioning of the child of that age did not necessarily imply anything so extraordinary as to convey that this idea of the supernaturalness of the doctors or others in the audience. And so in other words, even though he did something that we find quite extraordinary, it didn't make him divinity. Okay? He asks a very, very intelligent question, and the sages are all inspired because he has to be like a prodigy. Okay, Jewish tradition gives instances of precocious and strangely advanced students. Besides scientific theological learning, which not to be necessary to take part in such popular discussions. If we may judge from the latter arrangements, not only in Babylon, but also in Palestine, there were two kinds of public lectures and two kinds of students. There were actually three, which we'll talk about in a minute. The first and the more scientific class was designated Kala, not Chala like bread, but Kala the bride. Okay, literally, and he says here, literally bride. Okay. And its attendants, B'nei Chala, or the children of the bride, Okay, so there is two different classes here, the bride and the children of the bride. Okay, and these lectures were delivered in the month of Elul for the feast of the New Year, or Rosh Hashanah, and in the last month of Adar immediately prior to Pesach. Okay, let's just stop right there. Okay. I didn't hunt down the address, but it is general knowledge. It is in the Tractate Sanhedrin. It may be an 88B or a... I did not look. But when the Sanhedrin sat with a semicircle where the elders, 70 elders, sat, and then opposite of them, sitting also in semicircles, were all of the Talmudim, all the disciples. Now, that is during every sitting that the Sanhedrin, specifically the Sanhedrin Gedol, where they sit. Okay, so the front row is called the bride, and so let's say that on a given day, one of the 70 sages is not capable of coming. He's sick or something like that. What would happen is the first person, if you're facing the students as one of the Sanhedrin, the first person on the right in the front row was the most qualified Talmid. Okay? So he was going to get to come and sit in whatever position that he needed to sit to fulfill the role of the missing sage. Okay? Everybody understand what I'm saying? Okay? And so, when you looked at that front row, they were sitting in an order. Each, the order that they sat in was the order of their capability. Okay? So you started at the right. The most capable person was the person, the first person front row on the right. The least capable on the front row was all the way to the left.
It's the same way they do in an orchestra. Like if you're in the first chair, that means you're the most accomplished.
Yeah.
Someone.
Okay, so then there's a second row. And the second row was called the B'nai Chala, the children of the bride or the children of the front row. Okay, they're subordinate to the front row. They're not as intelligent as them. Not that they're not intelligent. They're not as trained and not as educated. Okay, so they're the B'nai Kala. Okay, and the same would happen there if something happened each time one of the Talmudim graduates, so to speak, and has the capacity to sit on the Sanhedrin. That person would move to the Sanhedrin and the row would shift. And this process is just like, you know, going through the lunch line, okay? So eventually you're going to get your place as long as you maintain your studies, okay? There, it said there that there was a time in the month of Elul and there was a time in the month of Adar. These sessions were called the Kala sessions, the sessions of the brides. And literally all of the sages would take part in these lessons, these sessions. And each person, including the Nasi, or the great person on the Sanhedrin, had to prove that he was still capable of holding his office. If he was not capable of holding his office, he was demoted. Okay? So this happened twice a year. So if you're going to be the number one student in the Sanhedrin, you couldn't just not do your job and think, I'm number one, I don't have to do that, etc. So the idea is that you have to have incessant Torah study to maintain your place and position. And now there's a lot of competition, but at the same time, the idea is to make sure, especially with regards to the Sanhedrin Gedol, that you have people that are truly qualified for office. Okay, suppose you're going to go to the doctor and you're going to have an operation. You know, wouldn't you like to know if this guy graduated at the top of his class? or if he cheated off the person's notes next to him. I
like that joke.
Yeah.
Oh, the joke?
They all bury their mistakes?
No. what do you call the guy last in class? Last, call him doctor.
That's right. That's exactly right. Okay. So, these sessions, and there's actually a tractate that is in the Talmud, but it's very, very mystical in many ways. It's not specifically so'od, but it's very, very cryptic. Let's put it like that. Okay, now, in some yeshivot, there was a third row. Okay? And I'm sure that this may... I don't know for sure, but it may have been the practice even during, you know, the sitting of the Sanhedrin. But the third row was a row that was called outer darkness. Okay, does that mean that this row is evil and wicked and all that stuff? No, it doesn't mean anything. It has a negative connotation, but you can understand that if it says an outer darkness, it's just saying these kids, they don't even know anything at this point. They're just beginning to be initiates. Okay, so he said if he casts somebody into outer darkness, in essence, what that means is that they don't have any Torah knowledge. Okay, no awareness of the Torah. Okay, as Evan and I were talking before class. One of the things he said, which is very important, and the way that we must learn to think about everything, and especially the Nazarene Codicil, and that is that we must first think about the Torah. Okay? That's primary. That's what you're thinking about, the Torah. Forget that it's the Nazarene Codicil. You are thinking about the Torah. So, if you're going to think about the Torah, and then you come to the Nazarene Codicil, your question should be, how does this relate to the Torah? Okay? So, for example, let's go to page 41. And this, of course, is a quite well... Sheba can tell you, as a, you know, I used to just always teach from Romans chapter 8. But this is a quite known passage here where it's saying, and the B'nai Elohim, or the sons of the judges, we inherit their judgments. Okay, now what it's saying here is that the judgments of the sages is passed down from rabbi or sage to student. And so we inherit their judgments. We inherited how did they interpret the Torah. Okay, you understand what I'm saying? Okay, for example, you know, how you keep Shabbat. So you have the rabbis that tell us how to keep Shabbat. So if you receive those laws, then what you have is you received an inheritance. You received what was passed down from father to son, sage to student, etc. But really, we should not say that we received an inheritance, although inheritance is still a good word, but we shouldn't say we inherited. What should we say?
Your Eminence, shouldn't it be that we chose it? I mean, because we choose whether we study the Torah, whether we follow this Mishpatim or not, but we received it, you know, through our teacher.
Okay.
But I don't know what term you would call it.
Okay. Let's just read just a couple more words and we'll find it. He said, we received their judgments, Mishpatim and Chukot, now having our share in the Torah. That's your inheritance. Each person has a part in the Torah. Okay? And so these writings of the Nazarene Codicil are parts of the Torah. Okay, this Chacham Safed's part, this is his part of the Torah. He's explaining how these things work. The piece that we have from Chacham Shaul is, it's also a piece of the Torah. And our part of the Torah, or our share in the Torah. Now, this goes back to what we discussed or started discussing to begin with regards to transmigrations, etc. Each one of us has our share of the Torah. And the world is incomplete without that Torah. So, if the world is incomplete without your Torah, what happens if you don't do your job? We have a deficient world, so to speak. I'm not being condemning by any means. We just see the importance of us doing our job and us giving the cosmos, as it were, our piece of the Torah. And one thing we should always understand is that your piece of the Torah is yours. Yours alone. No one else is given that job. Only you are given that job. Only you are given that piece of Torah. And no one else can do your job. If you are not there to do your job, then it's left undone. Okay? So, I've talked about Adam and HaRishon, the first Adam, and him understanding and knowing what would do, he would do, but he also knew what all of us would do, and he knew that we would accept our role in the Torah and do our job. Okay? Does that make sense so far? Okay? Okay, let's go back to page 40. If your hand brings an occasion to sin, remove it. Okay, so here again we understand that this is not a literal interpretation, cut your hand off. But that's not to say that there weren't some that just believed that it was, and so especially with regards to some of those nations, if they catch you stealing, they just cut your hand off and you won't do it again. Okay? So they're taking these types of ideas quite literally, okay? So obviously, when it's very interesting, Chacham Shaul says, you know, fence it off. Okay, so what does that mean? If he says put a fence it off. Don't, you know, your hand wants to do sin, but you need to fence it off. Put a fence around it.
Just trying to say put a restriction on it.
Yeah, I put a restriction on it, but how do you put the restriction on it? This goes back to the way I taught with regards to the fences, because the first of them, the Abot says you make a fence around the Torah. So it's the proper thing to put a fence around the Torah, even though there are those that don't like the idea of saying that there has to be a fence. That's what Chacham Shaul is saying. Put a fence around the Torah. Okay, well, in this case, he's talking about put a fence around, say, your hand or your eye or whatever. So what is the fence? Okay, so if you, for example, the illustration that I've used that is not original with me, but there's a commandment that says, don't let the children touch the burners of the stove. Okay? So you're not even going to let the kids get close to touching the burner on the stove. So you're going to tell them, don't even touch the stove. Do not touch the stove. And if they understand not to touch the stove, then obviously you're setting a boundary between them and the burner, so to speak, so that they don't do that. Okay? What happens is when this turns into an issue that is ultra complicated, the mom says, no, don't touch the stove. And the grandmother says, okay, I'm going to build another fence before that fence, and that means don't even let the kids get in the kitchen. So what happens? It can go and it can be ridiculous, right? All you're trying to do is look out for the safety of the child. And, you know, there are times when perhaps it does take more than one or two fences, as it were. But the idea is to prohibit the hand by whatever means that you need to say. If I'm going through the fruit market and I pick up an orange and I put it in my pocket and carry it on out of the market, you know, then I've committed a crime of theft. So how do I resolve that? Keep my hands in my pocket. Keep my hands on my billfold and my money. So if you're gonna take your billfold out and buy it, then okay, you can have one. Okay. Okay. So if your hand brings an occasion to sin, remove it. Just take it out of the loop. Don't even let it get to that place. And sometimes that's very easily said and not easily practiced. Okay. It is more beneficial to enter life crippled than to enter in Gehinnom in an unquenchable fire. Okay. First of all, notice here. It says it is more beneficial to enter life. Okay? So when it says this, it's talking about, number one, the Yomot HaMashiach, the days of Messiah, and number two, the Olam Haba. Okay? So those who know how to practice these fences know how to live when it comes into the Olam Haba. Okay? So more beneficial to enter life crippled than to enter Gehinnom in the unquenchable fire. The Gehinnom in Hebrew is actually two words. Geh is the valley and the Hinnom is the location. Okay? If you look at Jerusalem, especially in antiquity, you could draw the letter Sheen, the three-legged Sheen, and up in the upper right-hand corner of the right-hand leg, you put a dot there that makes it say the SH sound. If the dot is on the left-hand side, it just says an S sound. So the temple would have been about where the dot was on the right-hand side. And there would have been a valley. There is a valley that comes down that side and it meets at the bottom. And that is called the Kidron Valley. This valley is often also called as the Valley of Death, only because that's where a multitude of tombs and graves are at. Okay? There is a reason that they're there, because it says Messiah will have to come through the Eastern Gate. And so he's comes through the Eastern Gate. He can't cross the tombs of the dead people, so how will he get through the Eastern Gate? He has to resurrect all the dead first. Okay, so that's why the tombs are there. They're resurrecting the dead. So he can go through that gate. Okay? So that's where David says, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, that's that valley, from the Mount of Olives across to where the Temple Mount is, that valley right there, the Kidron, is the Valley of Death. There is the next valley that is called the Tyrophian, which is the center leg of the Sheen. It goes, now it's almost impossible to find this valley only because it's been filled in and houses have been there. But in antiquity, you could, if you look from the air, you could see this sheen, so to speak. And on the extreme left is the final valley, and it's called the Hinnom. Okay, and it, all three of them come together at the bottom. At the top on the right-hand side is the most blessed place on the earth. And at the bottom, where they all three converge, is the most cursed place in the earth. The most cursed place in the earth is where Jeremiah has his vision of the potter. And so, I've had people tell me, in those graphic terms, go to hell. He said, I've already been there, and I've come back. I've been to that place. It's not a good place to go. It took Yireh Gibor and Adon Tzuriel there. I took them to hell with me. We took a bus ride out of hell, and I don't know which was worse, being in hell or being in the bus. Okay, and the reason, of course, that this is Hinnom, this place in the Hinnom, why it was associated with hell and the most evil, is because it was the garbage dump. And so even in antiquity, you know that there's, you know, gases in the garbage. They throw the stuff out and the gases burn. And when they burn, they just never stop burning. And so this was the picture or the image of hell that they had in the first century, this place called Hinnom. Okay? All right. It says, and they rebelled against me, for their worm will not die and their fire will not be quenched. Okay? So what do these two phrases mean? What is worm? What is their worm?
Their soul?
No. It actually refers to the worms, if you will, that consume the flesh. And it said the worm will not die. So now you should be getting an image here. What image are you getting? So if you see that a worm is going to be consuming this flesh, and it says that the worm will not die,
it means that the worm will die instead of the body, but then where would be the everlasting torment?
Okay, but it said the worm will not die.
I guess he's going along with you.
He's going for the ride as well. Okay, look at what it's trying to say is if the worm doesn't die, then that means that there's always something to consume. Right? If the worm doesn't die, he's still eating something, so it means that he's still consuming this. So it means it's going to be a very, very slow and a very, very painful process. I kid with people when they come in my house and my dog is 3 pounds, almost 4 pounds now, I guess. And she's barking and yapping and carrying on. I said, be careful. She's going to eat you alive, and it's going to be a slow and a painful process. It's kind of like, how do you eat an elephant? Okay. So the process here, by both of these analogies, is that number one is, if it says it's not going to die, then it means that this is going to be a very long and a very, very painful process. And it said their fire will not be quenched. So again, it's drawing both of these conclusions against both of these analogies. Number one, it will appear as if the fire is eternal. And number two, the rotting and decay of the flesh. They'll be very aware of the decay of their flesh. And they will be in a boring for all flesh. So we've seen, all of us, the movies about zombies or whatever goes on and all that junk. If your foot brings an occasion to sin, remove it, for it is more beneficial to enter life emasculated than to be thrown into Gehinnom in unquenchable fire. Okay, basically the rest is very much a repetition of the same idea, and it is built out of Yeshayahu 66 verse 24, the last verse of Yeshayahu, the book of Isaiah. And of course, Isaiah is using Midrash, and you can also understand that this is associated with Midrash in this particular case. Why? Excuse me. Said, if your eye brings an occasion to sin, cast it out. Is more beneficial to enter the kingdom of God through the Bate Din and the Hakamim as opposed to the human kings with one eye than to be thrown in the fire of Gehinnom with two eyes. Okay, let me just explain a couple more things about that, and then we will just briefly touch in Romans. Okay. I didn't look up the verse, but I think it's in the latter portion of the book of Revelation, the Revelation. Eventually, and this goes with the question that Gibberet Marit asked, which is very apropos for the class, but it says in the Revelation that death and hell will be cast into the lake that burns with fire. What does that mean? No idea? Okay, it says death and hell will be cast into lake that burns with fire. Okay? So there will be a conclusion to death, and there will be a conclusion to hell, but it'll be cast into a place that is called the lake of fire. Where would that be?
The Dead Sea.
Okay? Josephus calls it Lake Asphaltus. If you ever go to the Dead Sea and you float in the Dead Sea, there's all sorts of minerals and all these things that have washed down into that place. But one of the things that you're very aware of and very conscientious of is when you come out is the amount of oil that is on your skin. So the oil that is there in the time of the first century was actually harvested by the Romans. And it was another source of petroleum. And they would use it for many different things because obviously if you know anything about oil, which you Texans should, that there are all different grades of oil. Okay? Gas, diesel fuel, they're all a part of the same product, oil. But they have to be fractured to get them at their particular level of combustion and use, etc. Okay, so eventually death and hell will be cast into the Dead Sea, and they will not exist anymore. Is it interesting that you call the place that death and hell are thrown into a place that's called the Dead Sea. I took Aron Suriel there, and I told him when we got to the Dead Sea, we were going to catch some Dead Sea bass. There was only one, and somebody already got it long before we got there. So I think he ended up there by mistake. It wasn't... you'd be surprised what you can tell people when you're on a trip to Israel, what they'll believe. If you have people like Adon Yehoshua, maybe he'll hear us. But you can tell him, look, there's a green olive tree. And then on the other side of the road, say, look, there's black olive trees. We pulled that on Adon Yehoshua. He didn't know the difference. Why is one black and why is one green? He needed the ladies in the kitchen to explain it to him. It's the shape of the leaf or something like that. I don't know what it is. Revelation 20:14. Thank you, Gibberet Sheba. Here, death and hell is thrown into this. Now, this is the point where what Gibberet Marit was asking, this is the point of annihilation. Stop and think about this for just a second. You know, we suffered hell on earth in the early middle 40s because of a man who was a tyrannical and he did his best to annihilate the Jewish people, and of course he was not the first by any means, we all are aware of that. But all of us right now, we can say, remember the Shoah, remember Auschwitz, remember how many people were killed, 6 million of us were killed. We could say that. But when we reach the place that those things will be annihilated, it won't even be a part of our history anymore. So how do we rid people of some of the pains and the experiences that they had? Annihilate them. Get rid of them completely. They're gone. Now, I'm not talking about necessarily any big supernatural act. I am talking a lot of it has to do with a lot of work that we have to do as well. And that's a whole nother complicated subject. Okay, page 40. So then, brothers, you are not obligated to the Yetzer Hara to live according to the inordinate physical desire. For if you are only living according to the desires of your Yetzer Hara, the result is spiritual annihilation. But if by the Nefesh Yehudi, you put to death the inordinate physical desire, you will have your part in the Olam Haba. So it's easy here to see the connection between the Peshat and the Remez. What's Hakam Shaul doing? He's telling you how to solve the problem. Okay? And one of the ways that we are able to master the Yetzer Hara, according to the Talmud, is to take that filthy creature to the study house, to Torah study. Okay, I will conclude with this particular statement. Said you'll have your part in the Olam Haba. He said, "For the B'nai Yisrael, the sons of God, are led by the instructions of the oral Torah, the Ruach HaKodesh. Spiritually speaking, you are no longer enslaved to Mitzrayim, causing Judah to live in fear, but you have been adopted by through the Nefesh Yehudi, whereby we cry out, Abba, Father." Two things that you should notice here. Number one, he makes the analogy of the Yetzer Hara being like being enslaved in Mitzrayim. Okay? There was a minimal amount of what you could do in Mitzrayim as a Jewish person, especially when it reached the time of the great time of difficulties. How long did that era of difficulties last?
Millennium.
He said they would only be there for so many years. It talks about 400 years, but they were never there for 400 years. It's 400 years from the time of Isaac till the time that they walk out on his birthday out of Mitzrayim. Okay? But were all of the years that they lived in Egypt this harsh slavery? So how long did this harsh slavery last?
Two hundred and ten years.
I think you need to put a razor to that.
Oops.
How can we tell?
40.
Say 40. Someone say 40.
Okay.
Yeah. No, not 40. When Aaron was born, the oldest of the three, there was no statute by Pharaoh at that time to throw the male children into the Nile. So it came after Aaron, but just before Moshe, 3 years. Most likely 3.5 years.
But that's a,
yes, ma'am?
You said the harsh slavery lasted approximately 3.5 years, is what you're saying?
Yeah. It wasn't, they didn't try to kill Aaron. At that time, they weren't trying to kill the male Jewish babies. But when it came time for Moshe, that season, yeah, they said, okay, let's kill the male babies.
But wouldn't that be when slavery started, not necessarily when it ended?
No, it would have started. That's what I'm saying. It started then. And it ends with them, of course, walking out of Egypt on Pesach. Okay? Okay, one other... Okay, go ahead. You have another...
So that was about 40 years.
No, no, no. No, it wasn't 40 years.
How was Moshe when he took him out? It had to be more than that, because wasn't he 80 when he went back to get him?
You're correct. How long did it start? And then it starts, yes. So it's only 43 years. That's what I should be saying. Thank you. You're correct. It started between the two of them, and then for the time that Moshe, yes. Okay, so I'm sorry, Don Avaja, you were pretty close. One other thing here as we get ready to close. I've actually translated something here that needs to be corrected, and I will correct it this evening. But You've been adopted through the Nefesh Yehudi, whereby we cry out, Abba, Father. What's wrong with that statement? Figure it out.
Take a stab at it. You haven't been adopted by the Nefesh Yehudi. The Nefesh Yehudi the Nefesh Yehudi, or the Holy Spirit of Ruach HaKodesh, didn't adopt them. It wasn't by the Nefesh Yehudi. You attained the Nefesh Yehudi through your adoption.
Yeah, that's a little bit of semantics, but that's not what I'm fishing for. Should not say Abba Father. Why not Abba Father? Jews, the Jewish people, do not talk that way. Our Father, Abinu, our Father. Jew never says my father, he says our father. He connects himself with all the Jewish people. Yeshua taught them to pray how? Our Father who is in heaven. Jews never pray in the singular, they pray in the plural. Always connecting themselves with the children of Israel. So,
aren't there certain prayers?
Yes, there are. Yes, there are. Yeah. You say the Viduya, bedtime Viduya, you can say things related to you, but you're still connected to the children of Israel. But yeah, there are certain times when you should pray by yourself, but basically, here's the right way to pray. If you have a difficulty, and you're going to confess to God and ask forgiveness, how do you form that prayer? In the plural, connected to the Jewish people, because you're not the only one with that kind of a problem. Okay? That's how we pray on Yom Kippur, right? You stand up there and confess all these things that you didn't even have any association with. But you don't know the rest of the congregation. They might have had trouble with one of those things. And so they can stand and say aloud, you know, whatever the prayer was as they're reciting it all head. Okay? So Jews and Jewish people associate with one another. So if you have a particular problem, you say, Our Father, God help us to accomplish or conquer this situation. Not me. You know, they used to say, you know, the prayers that we prayed in certain circles, it said that it would be us four and no more. And my name is Jimmy. Gimme, gimme, gimme. Right? I want a Cadillac. I want a... Okay. Everybody understand what we talked about this evening? Just so you know, I know I don't have an air, it makes a recording, but I also put this up on Torah Focus. It's usually up by Shabbat, before Shabbat. So, and you can go to Torah Focus and download there. We're trying to make some more innovations to Torah Focus, but it all takes time. Okay, if there are no other questions or comments,